do want to make it very clear that both of our organisations believe firmly that democracy in South Africa is working, but we also believe that there have been significant shortcomings in Parliament, particularly significant shortcomings in our experience of the last 8 years. We engaged Parliament from 1995 and up to 1999. We had a very functional relationship.
Recently, we've lobbied the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services on the question of the inadequacies and the failings of the treatment program when it comes to prison, but the apparent ability of Parliament to take steps on that has forced us into a lengthy process concerning access to treatment for prisoners at Westville Correctional Centre, court case that continues to go on. And the final example is where, again, we feel that parliamentary oversight has been less than is required is in relation to duties that arise under legislation. In this particular instance, the Medicines and Related Substances Control Act, which obviously requires proper policing of medicines which are registered and which are not registered, and where falling on deaf ears of submissions that we made concerning contravention to that act eventually required resort to the court once more against Matthias Rapp to try to get the Department of Health to do what Parliament should have instructed it to, which is properly protecting the integrity and dignity of its own legislation. The final 2 points that I would like to make is that we're beginning, we believe, and we'd just like to draw this to your attention, to witness a vicious circle that we believe undermines certain crucial aspects of our democracy and of the separation of powers. In the realm of health, we have seen submitted to Parliament a number of bills from the executive, which often appear designed to weaken the mandate and the independence of key statutory councils and institutions. In particular, bodies like the South African Nursing Council, the Medicines Control Council, and the Health Professions Council of South Africa. In keeping with the way Parliament works, we have drafted written submissions to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Health, pointing out that weakening the independence of these bodies is not only potentially unlawful, but weakens our capacity to supervise and oversee key aspects of the system of health governance in our society. Those recommendations, and most recently, and one of my colleagues will expand on this in relation to the South African amendment to the South African Nursing Act, seem to be totally ignored, despite the fact that both written and oral submissions were made to the Portfolio Committee on Health. There's no evidence in the subsequent regulations of those submissions. And the consequence becomes a situation where these bodies become severely weakened and no longer able to play the oversight and regulatory role that is expected of them by legislation, and no longer able to provide accurate information to Parliament, which Parliament requires in order to perform its responsibility. This leaves responsibility for checking the abuse outside of Parliament, and in particular in the hands of the court and of civil society, which is not the place where we believe it should be located in the first instance. If that role was being played properly at an earlier stage, to take away the necessity for civil society to play this watchdog, vigilant role constantly, and would allow civil society more flexibility to engage in other areas. I'd like to conclude briefly with two other issues just to flag for the panel's attention. On the issue of budget, we'd like to raise a concern that we often feel that legislation that is passed through Parliament is passed without a consideration of the cost implications of that legislation. And if there isn't a consideration of the cost implications of the legislation, almost from the beginning that legislation doomed to problems with regard to implementation. Just to give you an example, national airports is a really important piece of framework legislation for the governance of the whole of our health system. But there's no evidence that when the National Health Act was discussed in Parliament, discussed at the level of the portfolio committees and eventually passed by Parliament, that the budgetary implications of the implementation of the National Health Act were considered. The consequence of that is that parts of the National Health Act become nothing more than a wish list because there are no resources to support the implementation of that act. And that links, I think, to the second point which concerns us, is that often after legislation leaves Parliament, there are very lengthy delays between the proclamation of that legislation and the actual implementation of that legislation. Again, the National Health Act is a case in point. There are key chapters of the National Health Act which have not been brought into effect yet. Those key chapters relate in part to the oversight institutions that the Act creates, and the inability to bring it into being as a whole, or at least to bring it into being as a whole within a fairly short period of time, undermines the whole at the ultimate. So, in conclusion, members of the panel, from myself, what we're trying to say is that we respect Parliament, we believe that the Constitution assigns a critical role to Parliament, and we would look to your report and to your recommendation for future guidance to try to ensure that Parliament lives fully up to the responsibilities that are given to it within the framework of our constitutional philosophy.
My key point would be on the issue of public participation, that tech notes reflect something that as of now they see that Parliament is allowed the public to participate in debates of policy making, and also before policy decisions are being taken. But the notes on the issue of health and safety, therefore, we feel that, although my second point would be on new policy issues, especially with a new national public plan, that we as a society have taken part into keeping this national public plan, and that we feel that there are currently key issues that need to be presented by public in the national public plan for the target of the NMP to actually implement it. And we feel that Parliament has a key role in terms of doing that. But also Parliament needs to define the role for itself as to how we're going to work in order to be able to actually be an oversight over this journey. We feel that issues like as presented in the central setting of the NMP concerning legal issues like revision of the these issues have not been debated publicly, and there have not been actions as yet. Issues of debate that should have come to the fore, and that public should be debating, like the issues of the national health insurance. This is long overdue now. The NFP was supposed to start implementing in 2007, and issues like that have not come to the fore for the public. We therefore, as a chief of action campaign, feel that we acknowledge the presence of the health portfolio policy, but we feel that he has not said the outside, and it has been very difficult for us to engage with the international portfolio committee. Therefore, the CAC will recommend to this committee that at least a joint contact parliamentary which is a cross-sectoral kind of committee, will have to be set up. This committee will have to provide oversight over energy, and also, you know, role and function. We also deal with legal issues as contained in the energy, also deal with issues of policy and reform, and also serve as a monitoring forum, which can be reviewed on an annual basis. Because the other thing that issues of HIV and health are very close issues, and it can't take only one type CEO with on the executive action. That would be the key points of our executive society action. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask Mr. Hagen to a little bit more detail on the main ways in which these three statutory bodies, the Medicines Control Council, the Nursing Council, and the Health Profession Council, would actually meet each other?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the panel. We've been engaged in making submissions over the years in a range of pieces of legislation, in particular the amendment last year to the Health Professions Council, to the Health Professions Act, the new Nursing Council Act in 2005, and a series of submissions we've made over the years in respect of the Medicines Control Council. Maybe I'll start with the Medicines Control Council first. I actually think that the very first manner in which the MCC, its mandate and independence were compromised, actually goes way back, unfortunately, to Act 1997, the very act that the AOP and subsequently the TAC were very strongly involved in supporting and in defending, particularly when the act came under attack in the Victoria High Court. In particular, what we have seen both with Act 1997 and subsequent amendments to the Medicines and Related Substances Act is the composition of the Medicines Control Council. The composition of that council used to be set up quite expressly in the legislation. That has now been removed completely and is now left entirely to the regulations. There is nothing in the Act which gives any guidance to the minister in determining who should sit on such council. There is no open procedure in terms of which candidates to this council are selected, are grilled publicly, and are to establish whether or not they're suitable for office. There are many other statutory bodies where those kinds of procedures have been established. The Media Development and Diversity Agency is one. Certainly the appointments to the board of the HSBC. I won't elaborate on that. In respect of the Health Professions Act, one key way in which that body has been undermined, we believe, is that prior to the amendment that has recently come in,
the professional bodies, so the psychologists, the doctors, for example, each professional body was entitled to elect its representative to the Health Professions Council. We recognize that there have been concerns about diversity and about representation and who has been elected to those bodies, but we don't believe that those concerns have necessitated doing away with elections at the professional body level to the HPC, and instead what we now see are direct ministerial appointments on the basis of nomination. There are other ways in which one can deal with the issues of confirmation that have arisen, the legitimate issues that have arisen. In respect of the Nursing Council, we initially had some concerns with the Act and also the manner in which appointments to the Nursing Council were to be made. But what has subsequently transpired, which exacerbates those concerns, is that the regulations, which came into effect in January of this year, actually go way beyond what the Nursing Act permits. I'll give one example. The Act says that three members of the Nursing Council have to be representatives of communities. The Act allows for all interested parties to be able to make nominations. On the basis of those nominations, the minister then has the power to appoint three representatives of communities. The regulations disregard what is in the Act, and instead they allow each of the nine MECs for health to nominate one person. Of those nine nominations coming from the MECs, the minister then gets to appoint three of those nine people to act on behalf of communities. So community representation is now being decided directly by the MECs and by the minister herself. So those are just some of the ways. The submission does give a little bit more detail, and if the committee deems it necessary, we can actually forward the original submissions we made on all of these bills and on the regulations. Just one final point on the Nursing Council regulations. It ties into Mark's point about ongoing oversight, but not only on the actual legislation, but on the regulation drafting process. We've looked at the final regulations, and they seem not to depart at all from the draft regulations that were published a few months prior to that. And it indicates to us that either our submission was not read at all, or the concerns that we raised were not even considered. We certainly didn't expect to see everything they'd raised coming into the final regulations, but certainly we expected, and our concerns regarding the unlawful nature of those draft regulations should have been taken seriously.
You have recommended the setting up of an all-party joint committee. Based, I suspect, on the same view of underperformance with regard to the oversight function. In what way do you think the setting up of such a joint committee will improve the oversight function? And secondly, don't you think that this joint committee will simply have more time to mirror the weaknesses of the health portfolio program?
Thank you. Jefferson, can he pick up? Can you pick up a bit?
The question in relation to this state that imposes the constraints are three, I'll point to three things. One is that the capacity of the individual MPs within Parliament to be able to pursue a particular issue, and linked to that is the question of the access that individual MPs have to resources, to hard information, to undiluted report on what is actually going on, particularly in relation to, for example, the health system, where there are problems in regard to the council. Those are two areas where, if there was a strengthening of capacity of the supporting portfolio committees and supporting committees, we believe that it's possible to make a difference. And it links into the point we made a minute ago, which is that, in our view, some of these statutory bodies ought to be things that input information that MPs can then process in order to perform the oversight function. The other thing that unfortunately that I have to say in our experience is sometimes what we perceive to be divided loyalty and misunderstanding of constitutional obligations and responsibilities. Sometimes we have had this experience with portfolio committees and houses that have come there as the enemy of the executive. And not as citizens right there as attempting to contribute to the society as a whole. And we get responses that are more like the responses of the defensive response of the executive rather than somebody who's meant to mediate and take it over from response. And that makes it very, very difficult. We put forward ideas, for example, through the Human Rights Commission, on what we consider to be duty with regards to human resource plans in South Africa, and an argument that we talk strongly about that the whole health budget is misconstructed because it's not based upon the calculation of needs for the health of people in this country. And the response that we get is we are the elected government, it's up to us to decide. We have the vast majority, and that's not the way the constitution works, it's what we've been doing. So those are three particular.
People of the party politics, the field of health?
Well, certainly in the field of health, and that's been our experience. I mean, as you know, health has been incredibly polarized. HIV has been incredibly polarized. And it's been very rare in our experience that we've encountered members of parliament who don't toe the party line in relation to HIV.
Much more effective in performing the oversight. And that takes me back to the question I asked, that if it is true amongst other things that party politics imposes a constraint, are you going to have that mirror even in the community of such an age?
hope not, because we would hope that the education is now more or less existing beyond the past controversies, although we have lots of making conduct charges and closing the file today. Mentally dual therapists and women sometimes wonder whether that's the case. But if I could just add a little bit to the point. You see, FANAC, which is South African National AIDS Center, which is obviously an important body, in all the states, it's the highest advisory body to government. Now, FANAC provides the advice to government, but responsibility finishes there. What exists to ensure that that advice, if it is good advice, is actually acted upon? There's nothing to do that at the moment. So part of why we're proposing this all-party parliamentary committee is because we believe that it could play precisely that oversight role and support the national effort around HIV by checking that these recommendations, where the recommendations are found, are actually given effect. And the other reason, to answer your earlier question about not duplicating the health portfolio committee, is because the National Strategic Plan is far broader, obviously, than just health. And there is a part of the National Strategic Plan that specifically is titled Critical Issues for Effective Implementation of the National Strategic of the NSP. And that deals with a number of legislative issues, such as, for example, amendments to the Patents Act, which may be necessary in order to reduce the price of medicine, issues around the decriminalization of sex work, which may be necessary or which is recommended in order to try to make it possible to reach disproportionately high-risk groups. There's a whole range of issues that, Parliament actually needs to seize itself and to focus on, and which there has not been that kind of public discussion up to now. So that's part of our thinking behind that.
For the record, I just need to make a correction. It is not my concern that the Joint Committee will duplicate the Health Committee, the Portfolio Committee. My concern is that it will duplicate the weakness of the Portfolio Committee. So if one weakness is the party politics, it is my concern that party politics will be duplicated in a way that we think that we will see the party committee performing the oversight function.
Thank you.
I'm sitting at the back bench. And I want to confirm that there is a persistent problem here in terms of lack of research. If you look at HIV and AIDS, a lot of the controversy of the HIV cases, in many instances, the controversy has been resolved by the scientists, but there isn't any capacity at all of the scientists in Parliament that understands the issues that can be information to members of Parliament for being look at the issues. I think an all-party committee on HIV and AIDS play a very significant role in terms of, for example, attracting that kind of scientific professional advice to members of Parliament. I take, for example, an unresolved maybe has been debated and resolved by scientists on the issue of mother-to-child transmission, is that dual and triple therapy improves the possibility that the baby of a HIV positive mother will be born without HIV. The World Health Organization has made a determination on this, but because of the over-reliance of Parliament on the Department of Health on various methods, this issue has not been pushed by Parliament, and I think it should be a matter that Parliament should be pushed. Secondly, on the issue of this all-party committee, I would think that it's an important intervention
in the sense that HIV is a cross-cutting issue, so it needs to deal with issues around education, issues on labor, so many different fronts. And this is something that the Fuller Commission on Health, while it specializes on a number of health-related issues, cannot oversee all the various areas in which people are affected by HIV. And then, more importantly, HIV is an emergency, and we do need a committee that will be able to quickly look at and resolve issues around HIV that remain unresolved. The issue, for example, around a breast milk, we have had this discussion here in Parliament to say, what should we be telling mothers in our constituency who want to breast milk, who are HIV positive? Is that the right thing, or is that not the right thing? And there are various other issues around circumcision, and HIV have not been debated here in Parliament. So Parliament doesn't have a position. Should we support it or should we not? So I would really think that this is an important intervention. But as I said, I think an all-party committee on HIV would be able to address the issue in a non-partisan way, in the sense that the support that would be coming to this committee would not be research support that has been forced by a particular party. Right now, the way Parliament operates is that individual parties are given money by Parliament, and it is out of this money that they employ research. So the ANC, for example, has got researchers to support the ANC study group on the community. I'm not sure how much support goes to the portfolio committee per se, which is non-party related. I think that would be something that we need to
thank you, Chair. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate the AIDS Law Project and the CAC for the role that they've played as part of the component of the civil society in playing the oversight role. And I'd just like to refer to the three lines of defense that Mr. Elders referred to in Parliament, the court, and civil society, which is yes. In a sense, playing a devil's advocate, because I'm not anti your proposition, but I think I'd like to test your proposition about the All-Party Committee. Parliament has been aware of the deficiencies that you have so eloquently spoken of. And in 1999, Parliament commissioned the research on oversight function, which resulted in three groups being formed, focus groups, mainly on budget, projects, and committees. And the task team on oversight and accountability is about, or presumably about, to complete that task. So the oversight function essentially then becomes an ongoing debate in terms of, is it effective? Is it effective? How much is it effective? Because it consists of a number of aspects, question time, plenary debate, committees, and so on and so forth. Now, you will know that the committees, for instance, have increased since 1994. And therefore, where I particularly agree with the submission is that it's a question of capacity in terms of effectiveness. There's so many members of parliament, whether opposition or ruling party, and there are so many issues to be debated. Do these people have sufficient backing in terms of capacity and so on and so forth? The point I'm coming to is that these portfolio committees are all-party committees, in that all political parties participate in them. Now, you're suggesting an all-party committee as if the PCs are not all-party committees, to me, kind of that's the question. And therefore, in testing your proposition, I say, don't increase the number of committees, strengthen their capacity, research capacity, allocation of time, IT, because people operate in these committees manually, and they're supposed to be everywhere, which you can perhaps to an extent achieve. If at all you actually literate and using PCs and storing your own information and being able to obtain information and so forth. So the short point, Chair, is don't increase them, increase the capacity, increase the efficiency levels, which I think at this moment indeed do leave my life. Thank you.
Yes, I think,
parliamentary committees, human civil society, as enemies of the executive. I don't know that whether that arises from the impression that the Age Law Society had when it interacted with the committee, or is just a perception, because this is a very serious issue for the committee. Because the political authority to legislate arises from the mandate that the committee took from civil society and other members of the public. Now, if there is such a statement before us, I think we need a concrete proof that this what really happens when submissions are made to committees. Committees regard civil society as enemies of the state. And I would want Mr. Hill to expand a little bit on that as to what created that expression.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope I'm right in your assumption that the presentation needs to be by Mr. Lander to say that some of the different symbols are and also you indicated that there's some representations we made parliament in the office to use the just to put up on the all party committee, and I share said this concern about the protection of the committee to balance yet another committee. And also just to say that in fact all committees in parliament are all party committees. Grand Committee is essentially committees of the National Assembly and to meeting together, that constitutes the Grand Committee. I'm not sure on the issue of health or the government in the sitting of the CFMA. Maybe structural and that needs to be looked at and see how to make all the committees more effective. Rather than say it's more committees, but make committees much more effective than they currently are. The general concept of the committees, maybe they're overworked, maybe there are too many committees, certainly there is a need to increase the support of the committee to make the rest of it effective. And of course, also to reduce the turnaround time, that once children are tabled, then you know, to the strict numbers point, even once it's up to the years, the turnaround time of response should be shortened somewhat. I'm not sure how that can be done, but clearly it's an issue that we need to look at here, how to improve the other one was around the issue of the budget and the legislation. To say that legislation is passed without due consideration of the cost implications that it will have. Certainly, with the kind of legislation that's going through, and I don't know how many hectares of legislation a year, and cost each one of those is really going to be really difficult. In practice, I'm not sure how it can be done. Ideally, you would want to know any major piece of legislation that is going to pass, how it should impact on society, how it should impact on objectives, how it should impact on all kinds of things, and impact on the pitch. Take you the thing of social grant, clearly, you know, those kinds of things need to track that, how it should impact on the fiscal, which should be intended for. That's one set of things. What from a huge piece of legislation grant ever. There's another one which is not really the first unintended consequence of this piece of legislation. Sometimes you pass a piece of legislation only to find that it comes to this other piece of legislation elsewhere, and that you're supposed to come there and read to it. It's not specific to the issue that you raised on today, but generally the working of Parliament. The working of Parliament clearly has those kinds of elements. And finally, the question is, I know you've given us a summary and we're going to look at your figures and going to study some of them. But certainly we send a final affair definitely to an email, etc. If there's anything that you think of what you have, and certainly feel free to pass it on to the panel.
On the cost implications of the legislation, do you think it's a simple matter of inefficiency that the cost implications of the legislation are seldom discussed, or do you think when they are not discussed, it is a block to avoid implementing what has to be done? Honourable Member Magala is himself that HIV/AIDS is an emergency. When you look at the conduct of Parliament, does the conduct of Parliament support the rule that HIV/AIDS is an emergency? Going back to the constitution of the legislation, is it your view that as a nation and as Parliament, we had a conversation about money bills, that this discussion about money bills will to some extent solve the problem of issuing legislation? And then lastly, all these deficiencies you pointed at are deficiencies that others have come here and pointed at. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but don't you think if we had a different political and electoral system in which the political party is not so dominant, that the outcome is different?
Just one question to maybe, I think it's Nono, the name. I agree with you fully that public participation is essential and Parliament should facilitate it. But you know, I'm aware of one problem, that whilst we may be equal now before the Constitution and the law, the economic divide is still there. Participation means making it possible for people to travel and accommodate and there are those tools I know exist within Parliament, even though I'm not a front bencher or a front bencher. So how do you deal with that? Participation is not where it should be, but you've got that practical problem to deal with, and it just doesn't happen. I don't know if it will happen.
Yes, Madam Chair, I was very grateful for this presentation. In a sense, it encapsulates the problem which we have, I think, haven't grappled with, but has come before us, and that is the question of how you reconcile the interests of the people with the authority of the parties which are represented in Parliament. This is a conflict situation. If I see the TOC, it is an organisation of people. And it's got to promote the interests of people, that's what it is. It hasn't got a vested interest as an institution. And part of it consists of people not elected by the people, but nominated by political parties, and accountable to political parties, and you can be dismissed from Parliament by political parties. And the dominant political party, which is a reality, the leader of that political party is also the head of the executive. So it's not only the party that impinges on Parliament the rights of the people, but it's the dominance of the executive over Parliament. And I think it's this problem. How do you see that Parliament is more sensitive to the people and less compliant with the will of the party bosses? And if you've got any suggestions on this score, we'd be very grateful.
Going back, Madam Chair, to the question of committee and the experience of the CAC and the April project being pretty well uniform, or are there some committees that have been more responsive than others to issues you have raised with them? We've heard from other people giving evidence now that there's quite a wide variety of attitudes that are shown by the various portfolio committees. I'd be interested in your experience.
I thought this is really, really harmful. It's not an excuse for competition to get money results, and you know, it should be a right that public needs to have in terms of before decisions are made. I'll make a quick an example. If we say that, how much more money are we spending when we have to actually that they're being contacted by the public because they've been not made by because they haven't been not actually paid interest in it, they have not been paid. So when these laws now have to be contemplated for very much more money than we could have spent when public to be actually paid.
Some of the questions are so complicated that we can have a few hours to answer it, but I'm going to try and do them in a few minutes. I'd just like to come back to the things that were raised by the panelists about the idea of the passing bonuses. I think we're proposing it for the two reasons that were given by Selby, which are not exclusive or in conflict with each other, which is that there is a need to increase capacity for all the portfolio committees. We don't dispute that. But at the same time, there clearly is a need for an all-party parliamentary committee to deal with the HIV epidemic, partly because of the scale and catastrophe of the HIV epidemic, but partly because it's an issue that cuts across all of the different portfolio committees, and we think it would be more efficient if they sat in one body to consider those, to work on those issues, rather than just hoping that by accident there's a passing of information, passing of joint strategy making between between different parties. Our country has a partnership on AIDS now that sits through the South African National AIDS Council, and that brings together outside of Parliament different government departments, civil society, and so on. Parliament should have a partnership of its different parts on AIDS. It would strengthen our response to the epidemic and to many of the strategies that need to be taken. We wouldn't be alone in doing that. There are precedents for all-party committees, parliamentary committees on AIDS. There's a functional one in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, in the Philippines. It's generally something that is recommended by the World Health Organization and UNAIDS. And yes, I think we would all benefit by exploring just precisely what we want to achieve by it so we don't make mistakes, we don't duplicate inefficiencies and so on. But as the TAC and the ALP, we do believe that it would enhance and strengthen our response, including the oversight of Parliament over government. On the question of costing of legislation, this is really something. Maybe we can make a written submission to yourselves and try to expand on the idea a little more. Not every piece of law that goes through Parliament will have significant cost implications. Not every piece of law. But if you take the National Health Act. Chapter 2 of the National Health Act, I think it's titled Rights and Duties, something like that. It's about the rights of healthcare users and the duties of healthcare workers. And it's a wonderful chapter about your right to confidentiality, the fact that you must give informed consent to every medical procedure that is performed on you, your right of access to information. It's all necessary in terms of the Constitution. You can't shy away from giving those people those rights. But the reality is just completely different. If all you're doing is piling on healthcare workers a new set of responsibilities, and you haven't even considered the human resource implications of putting that into legislation. So at least on an issue like that, there should have been some discussion. If we are going to say that every person who walks into a hospital or a clinic has these rights, and if we mean, then what implication does it have for human resource issues and for costing issues. Similarly, the National Health Act says that the minister must prescribe an essential package of healthcare services available to all South Africans. That's great. We do need an essential package of healthcare services. But it's 2 years since the Act was passed and there's no essential package of healthcare services being defined. Why, perhaps this goes to Aubrey's question, I mean, is it inefficiency or ploy? Well, maybe it's a bit of both. Because the moment you define the essential package of outsourced services, you've got to have a, surely got to have a budgetary strategy to prepare to realize that. We don't have it and it stays, keeps that day away. So again, we're not trying to suggest tax solutions. These are difficult things and we're aware that they're difficult things, but even if it's just a question of alerting Parliament to the fact that there is going to be a necessity in certain instances to make particular considerations around pieces of legislation, otherwise you just continue with this problem of putting stuff out into society, which actually doesn't play a significant role in regulating the way things operate. But I don't want to put words on my colleagues, but if you were interested, we would be happy to expand on those ideas outside of this. The last thing is the question that was asked about the allegation that I made about being viewed as enemies of the executive. And the question also raised about my experience with the party with different chemicals. What I'd like to say is that this is the exception, not the rule. But it has happened. And it is the perception, very felt experience of members of the A4 project in the treatment action campaign, particularly before the Health Portfolio Committee, to be treated as if we are enemies and not people who are coming to try to make presentations in the best interest of society. Why? Well, that goes perhaps to the heart of a number of questions which have been raised. The reason why is because for 3 years between 2000 and 2003, we used every means at our disposal to try to engage Parliament on what we considered were governmental and parliamentary responsibilities in dealing with the AIDS epidemic, and particularly to try to commence an antiretroviral treatment program. That fell on deaf ears. We were forced to embark on an extra parliamentary campaign that began with a march outside of Parliament on the State of the Nation Day of 2003, the Civil Disobedience Campaign. That made us enemies, because people in the executive were saying that we were pharmaceutical company agents, that we were just trying to sell drugs. That's what was being said about us. And people on the Health Portfolio Committee were answerable to people on the executive. And so we were treated as if we were actually coming with hidden agendas rather than coming in the best interest of society. And that becomes a deterrent for public participation. Hinders progress on that. And it's also because there are people on that committee who we've had conflict with. The former MEC for Health in Mpumalanga, who there was conflict with because she dismissed doctors for providing treatment for rape survivors. That carries into the conduct of Parliament and becomes a serious difficulty. We hope that is going to change. And to answer the question about, you know, I don't think it's for us to say whether there should be a different electoral system. What I do think it is for political parties in Parliament to make sure that every member of Parliament understands the Constitution and understands the constitutional prerogatives and imperatives and duties that are created by the Constitution so that people can be treated properly and not understood, even if you're saying something that's not right, where you're coming from. The response from all committees is not the same. We've had positive, we've engaged a number of committees, education committee, the trade and industry, even the correctional services, and had positive engagement both in the oral presentation and in the result and ongoing communications. After you make a presentation, somebody from Parliament phones you up and says, can you give us this? And can you give that? That's how it should work. So again, it's not the rule, it is the exception, but it's significant enough as the exception to be something that we feel needs to be drawn to your attention. Perhaps one way to deal with, I don't know how to deal with these problems, but perhaps we should summon the executive and ask them how they handle these particular, how they will handle these issues and difficult issues in future, because there will be difficult issues as we go forward in future. I'm sorry that.
So we'll hand it out after the presentation. And the next one also, no? The parliamentary.
So you have the
Thank you.
someone is cutting grass.
Something wrong with the
I
sound.
Can't hear. There should be a loudspeaker. There should be a third one.
Mm, but there's something wrong with the sound. So.
Yeah. What is next?
Legal assistance.
Sometimes
support the full inclusion of the Parliament of the state beyond what the Constitution allows to do. And that's a very important tension. It's very important for the process in terms of the extent to which we're able to get it right in the parliamentary process. Versus for the need to approach courts to resolve sometimes very difficult policy issues, and more importantly, very difficult issues of resource allocation and issues of budget. Chair, our specific focus of the LRC has been specifically with regard to the socio-economic drivers in the Constitution. And besides the socio-economic drivers, also two issues I want to raise with regard to other rights. One is the broad right of access to justice. We make some comments on the gap in question time around some of our experiences around issues of the legal aid board comes to so far and how those presentations have impacted on the gap in justice. The second area other than social economic rights has been our work with academics. Every day in the office of the LRC, we have data, and we have literally tried hundreds of refugees from all over, DRC, from Zimbabwe, all countries of Africa, with complaints about their ability to be without survive of our own cities. Now, I raise this because the extent to which we're filling our office means there's a failure in our ability to face the problems efficiently and silently from our cities. So I raise this because I think funding is an important oversight role. And you know, we've seen huge efforts in change and initiatives by the department in recent 19 years. The problem is, you know, with the pandemic and the expense of which every day thousands of more people have to be up, other organizations and civil society is a testament to the extent to which we've had to deal with this. I want to deal with focus of the organization is social economic rights. The Section 26 and Section 27 stipulate that those rights must be progressively stabilized by the state on the basis of the available resources. And that's a very important injunction on the state of what we can find. The extent which we're able to realize the promise of those rights lies full square on the ability of Parliament or the people of the country to directly realize those rights. And then more importantly, to ensure that those representations regress the court, but it then erodes the rights which have been won either by the DST or either in court or either by Parliament itself. But more importantly, to ensure that the process is fulfilled. So one of the debates we had amongst ourselves before coming to you, we're presently engaged in litigation with regard to the communal land rights act. And the debate is whether and how much information we might share with you with regard to what issues are in that act. We're going to leave it to you perhaps to ask us how much you want to know. We must certainly hear one to be preempting a court process. The matter in extent before Parliament would be adjudicated and therefore to be deliberated by members of Parliament. But your committee might well be different and might well be disposed looking to some very pertinent issues about it. So I thought that's our way of introduction. Steve will now talk to us about the medical. Maybe Steve will perhaps decide both of us on the public participation issues raised by the DSL and the other gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Speak into the mic.
First of all,
turn the mic towards you, yeah.
I don't think that this is actually your thing in Ghana, not the thing. Once again, on behalf of the people of public interest lawyers, which is what LRC houses, we are honored to go here to all of them. If you can contribute towards understanding how Parliament can assist in during this year, I think we may not find it beneficial. For us, it's monitoring as part of the TAC in this particular hearing, or very simply, they have some clients that are also here. And it's from their experience, from their members' experience, the information that comes to them, who are on a state application person, and they're also. And that type of public participation, and all types of public employers, what we need to do is take up the advice and the right to I think MS is an important difference that we have. If that public participation aspect that we benefit from it in our time, we're also not products of our partners who have more knowledge of the future. So the character of the work is covered in the Constitution and public participation. We hear about very basic, if you don't hear it, you don't accept the I'm going to speak briefly to down the requirements of the Constitution that we've got, particularly in the document of our case. The case heard in August 2005, the judgment was handed down in August 2007. That's the document of the 18 months ago. It strikes me that it's not too long for the panel both to have a look at what the judgment requires, and that's what I will try and cover. To have a look at what extent we have been compliant with those requirements. In our submission to you, we pointed out that there seems to have been very little discriminating Parliament in the way of guidelines for people, encouraging public participation, voting for participation. We picked up on the one particular newspaper document that doesn't think that's a copy of, which we would refer to it, that there has been no direct indication of much more activity in the body. In fact, that's it. But how to encourage more and more participation. I don't think you're going to be in your second of the paper. It's a simple situation where the applicants challenge four pieces of health legislation and grant the NTOC, not the National Community, and not comply with Section 72.1A, obligations in terms of involvement, to infer that they haven't been compliant with public involvement in the province of England. Court judgments are mildly or lengthy, and they are conferring and definitive judgments. But the key judgment, Judge Sandeep Fogel, conferred in by seven other judges, and Judge Albie Sackville to file a separate conferring judgment, and that eight judges come out very clearly in regards to the aspect of the consultation. We can have a look at a number of points from the issue. First of all, the majority says that Section 72.1A did impose on the NTOC obligations to facilitate public involvement in both legislation and policy. The party, who came before the court, were entitled to make allegations that they haven't been compliant with it directly to the Constitution. In fact, it therefore means that if there isn't compliance, the party will be able to have direct access to the court in many instances without having to go through the lengthy use of lower courts. And the Constitutional Court held that it did have jurisdiction to comply with that initial. The court agreed to this does affect the separation of powers, and the court will keep the Parliament as yet its obligation to determine the Constitutional Court. If it asks the Parliament to say to know what it should be doing, it won't determine what is required in regard to the Constitutional Court, which is the time that somebody admitted that it has been complied with. Whether it's as we see it, paragraph 418 and page 418 in the judgment, it spells it out as follows. By contrast, where the obligation requires Parliament to determine in the first place what it needs to be and to put its obligation in, a review by a court whether that obligation has been fulfilled preaches on the autonomy of Parliament to regulate the policy. It's an acknowledgement by the court that it's an empty of right. And thus, on the principle of separation of powers. This is precisely what the obligation comprehended in Section 72.1A of the Constitution does. While it imposes the primary obligation of Parliament to facilitate public involvement, and is led to another process, including those of the committee, it does not tell Parliament how to facilitate public involvement, but leaves it to Parliament to determine what is required in this regard. The court then went on to describe how it sees Parliament rights as follows. Having regard to the provisions of the Constitution and the international authority of all South African democracy, included one as one of its basic and fundamental principles, the principle of participatory democracy. The democratic government that was contemplated as partly represented in partly participation was accountable, responsible, and transparent, made provision for public participation in rulemaking process. Parliament has therefore to function in accordance with the principles of participatory democracy. Facilitation of public involvement in the legislative process is the taking steps to ensure the public participates in the legislative process. That is the plain meaning of this legislative and requires a balanced relationship between representatives and participatory elements in our democracy. So the challenge in a way is to try and create that balance. And it's all continuous in the step, but it's ultimately important because the legislature has taken steps to afford the public a reasonable opportunity to participate effectively in the rulemaking process. Thus construed in at least two aspects of the duty to facilitate public involvement. The first was the duty to provide meaningful opportunity for public participation in the rulemaking process. The second was the duty to take measures to ensure that people have the ability to take advantage of the opportunity to provide. And that was raised in the earlier debate yesterday about what type of opportunity in the end, however, the duty to facilitate public involvement often requires Parliament and the provincial entities as well to provide citizens with meaningful opportunity to be heard in the making of laws of government, which the Constitution demands no less. Thus, it suggests there is an obligation to ensure that not only members, but people who are wanting to come and make those representations have an opportunity to be informed, have an opportunity to communicate them, and possibly even to get assistance to regard to research and other information. The State Law Advisor was asked to have a look at these things, to have a look at our submission to you at paragraph 10 of that submission. What I'm doing is I'll briefly read through the extracts they have given you from the State Law Advisor. So what the State Law Advisor has done in his presentation to the Joint Committee of Parliament was to give an outline about how he thought the public consultation process works after the transaction. Reads as follows. The court noted that the provincial legislature in Parliament should have a discretion in deciding how best to facilitate public involvement. This could vary from case to case and would depend on factors such as urgency, the kind of legislation, whether it affected only a small group, or had a wider impact on the public. The court then indicated that it would have regard to what Parliament regarded as appropriate. However, it was ultimately important that Parliament had first afforded the public a reasonable opportunity for meaningful participation in the rulemaking process. And secondly, that the public was also given the ability to take advantage of that opportunity. In other words, there would be a two-stage process in the State Law Advisor. And an aside, not the draft December, but the previous one, December 2006, a short week before everybody disappeared on holidays, I think in the last government of the year, the Department of Health published proposed amendments to the Prevention of Illegal Eviction from an Unlawful Occupation of Land Act. That was put out for public comment. Put out for public comment, and all comments have to be submitted, I think, by the 30th of January. One has to look at the type of that mission coming from the senior law advisor of Parliament and the Supreme Court. There's that type of public participation process, and that word for comment won't be constitutional. It must be acknowledged that submissions were made to the department after that, and they tend to the time. But anybody putting out the legislation or comments within such a short period of time, particularly in legislation to protect the thousands of South Africans against eviction, which is accepted in 97, was not part of the time. The senior law advisor continues and says,
firstly, there must be local information. It might then be desirable to provide public education and capacity for provincial legislatures to create conditions conducive to effective exercise of the right to participation. The report gave us examples, roadshows, workshops, radio programs, and educational programs. Those were types of things that we say were advised and suggested that they will be appropriate. That may well be appropriate for public participation. In this particular case, we held that the NGO Group Select Committee that discussed the question of public participation and had opted and suggested that provincials were in safe space. They didn't deal with those facts. And in this particular case, the board then told that it was appropriate to help legislation and not invalid as part of the national process.
Parliamentary law advisor is not part of the state law advisor's office of the executive. I'm going to use my 5 minutes to just refer you to the paragraph in our submission where we deal with the issue of tax and whether legislation is treated in terms of the Section 75 procedure or the Section 75 procedure. And if you want to come back to public participation and experience of rural communities in Parliament currently, and there are limited notices in Parliament and common procedures for participation, there's nothing much more. And in the interesting census of Parliament of last year, when it reviewed itself, in anticipation of your reflection, Parliament's 2007 reflection, it mentioned that it was considering other ways of use of public participation, but essentially it evaluated itself as the level of common system as being adequate and it is fulfilling the role of the chair. I want to refer you to our submission, paragraph 28, which is on page 7. Of our document. Our document comes under the new heading, mission statement of the LRC and how it relates to your start here, Parliament's mandate and the panel's term of reference, current instruments to provide for public participation in Parliament's activities, and then you say something about USL and MFL government, and page 7 then introduces obstacles to effective participation in capacity and tag. Paragraph 28, it says that the role of the NCLP and provinces in making legislation constitutes a cornerstone of the constitutional legislation. In paragraph 30, it says, the fact that the NCLP must obtain mandate on some national legislation in terms of Section 26, in itself opens up a significant opportunity for public participation. For the first time, national legislation is being debated in the provincial capital, and not only in Paris. But what legislation should go to the provincial capital? Parliament employs a certain substance. Somebody sits and counts the number of sections, and if the sections deal with matter in, the majority of the sections deal with matter in Schedule 4 of the Constitution, it goes to 76. So the majority of legislation is classified as Section 75 and it's right through the National Assembly. It doesn't have to go for a 4 weeks, so as the Parliamentary Law Advisor now recommends, 6 weeks cycle in the provinces. Doesn't get the provincial mandate. We're saying that the certain substance test and borrowed from Canada is not appropriate and that the appropriate test is one which looks at the degree of the impact of the matter whether in substantial measure the content of the legislation affects provinces, provincial and local government functions. And that is currently towards the end of the year, there may be a resolution on the appropriate test for society, whether legislation is a fit and substance test. Even so, the fit and substance test is often used in a rather misunderstood manner. And we find that legislation goes to the problem. I said I wanted to say something about the experience of rural communities in Parliament. And I'm not going to deal with a frustrating experience of rural communities in 2015 when the traditional leadership and government framework goal was debated as a section for people. Or in the same year, running over 2004, the Communal Land Rights Act, which was dealt with. I will deal with two pieces of legislation, two goals that currently before Parliament and to introduce last year. In the absence of effective land reform and the rural social movement, those two pieces of legislation are probably the most important instruments for changing the rural landscape. The Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act allows for mining. Environmental Management Act, environmental impact procedures provide some opportunity for communities to participate in the future management. So those are very important instruments for the community. All these laws were subject to amendments last year. When we made that presentation to these laws last year, we were accompanied by leaders of the community, and the Community Development Association. They're not here today, so I think there's some change, but they're saying anything. Towards the end of May last year, the advertisement went out that the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Association was going to be implemented. Within 10 days, anybody who wanted to make submissions could come to Parliament to do so. Not much time. Dramatically, that draft bill, that bill, said that it's no longer necessary for a mining company to consult with the landowner or the occupier of the land. The rural community would not be get any notice that there's going to be mining on the land. They rushed to Parliament, explained to Parliament that this, at the very least, they should get effective notice and participate. The response of Parliament and the Portfolio Committee was as dramatic, because it insisted that the bill be changed by the executive, that the executive should consult institutions of administration, and the bill was in fact changed. In fact, the notice provision for owners and occupiers of land in Texas, communities put in the discretion of communities, even participate in mining and processing, future mining and processing in the discretion of communities. It's a dramatic victory for public participation. It happened in 2007. And if it wasn't for the efforts of the Community Development Association, that would not have happened. In fact, a right to be taken away, consultation rights to be taken away. And we can congratulate the parliamentary procedure, notice and comment procedure, with all its faults, for the improvement of the law, of the bill last year. But on the 19th of June, suddenly the Portfolio Committee introduced a further change. It now says that the National Environmental Management Act will not apply to anyone. This was at the instance of lobbyists at the time. this is a sea change of the intention and the opportunity for participation in decision making under the mineral. Now only the Minister of Minerals and Energy is going to talk about environmental considerations. Midway through the process, the wording of the bill was passed. Now there's no opportunity for public participation, and now the bill should have been transmitted. Now I'm not going to, we don't know the outcome of that till we get, because that bill is from the forecast. It didn't in fact go to the collection. In the meantime, another change to the National Environmental Management Act Amendment Bill, 36 of last year, also deals with some of the same subjects. It became very confusing because the two pieces of legislation are in fact incompatible and contradictory. Who are the victims in this process? The community who took managed to make a change and protect their rights, but then couldn't take the matter further to further representation because the bill didn't go to the and secondly there's no opportunity for a second round of participation. But most importantly, Parliament and parliamentarians who were not taken in the confidence of the and did not have fully prepared draft legislation to the party coming in for the approaches to the party. So, the notice and comment procedure has its own shortcomings between the we have a bit of background information about that.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Mine is not a question, it's just an observation, and just to make sure that I understand it, what is being presented here. What both presenters, in my opinion, have presented is a sort of like a flouting of the parliamentary process in terms of public participation. And what you are appealing for is for this committee to try and interrogate that and strengthen public participation and make sure that within legislation and public policy making that is not taken away, and also to bring to the attention of parliamentarians the contrasting roles that sometimes the executive might bring in terms of taking away the rights of the public to participate. Is that what you are bringing to our attention? Okay, thank you.
Overall, in terms of the experience of it's your view that meaningful public participation, there's a lot of public participation in provinces in here. Is it your view that overall it is meaningful or is your view to the contrary? And secondly, when legislation is written, which in fact takes away the rights of the ordinary people. Especially with regard to the question that was raised earlier about grassroots issues and access to public what extent do you think that such a taking away of rights is simply an overpass on the part of the Mashasa? Alternatively, to what extent do you think it is a product of the power of lobbying over public policy?
My impression on the submission that you made with regard to the law and the power to encroach on the legislative authority of the parliament. And I think that the cases that have been quoted are very clear on that. That the court do not want to interfere in the internal procedures of that as long as parliament has set out those procedures. But where the court interferes is where a constitution gives the right and parliament does not have a position to deal with that. And that is where the court is at least a minimum in focus on that separation. And you see here on the question of public participation, the constitution is very clear. It supplements this whole question of the proportional representation to say that we also need direct democracy where the people are consulted directly through public participation. And if Parliament does not have a procedure to engage the public on various pieces of legislation, then it's a vacuum where the court can come in and say, we have a problem. Because even minimum standards for public participation are not there. But you see, the academic argument that we had here with regard to the money being, where we were being told that Parliament can pass a bill even where the Constitution provides that there should be an act of Parliament that determines the procedure for passing that bill. You see, now that question, because of that provision, where the Constitution clearly says there must be an act of Parliament. If Parliament goes ahead without that act, it renders that piece of legislation voidable by the Constitution. So those are the issues that we must be seized with regards to this legal opinion personally. Because really, and in the schedule, the Constitution is very clear that where it concerns rights, then the Parliament should see to it that within a reasonable time, that is, I mean, there is a framework within Parliament for dealing with the rights that have been concerned by the Constitution. So I agree wholly with those issues of the law. And this is the way that Parliament should go.
Thank you. I got a bit confused in the discussion about the minerals legislation and the various drafts. And there was minerals legislation and environmental legislation. Now, am I correct in understanding that what happened was that the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee dealing with mining law overturned what the executive's intention was, and then that was subsequently overturned by legislation emanating from a different department. So that was an example of a parliamentary committee doing its watchdog function effectively. That would be my first question. The second question arises from what kind of said arising from the Doctors for Life case, there have been no subsequent guidelines issued by Parliament to regulate or control or ensure public participation. Is that correct?
The only example that we've seen of it is
the would it be a feasible, I mean, I think it's also Robert's question, would it be a feasible for legislation to be enacted that provided guidelines for public participation in both houses and for full participation, with regard to every single different government department? There's nothing on the statute book at the moment to give effect to this principle in the Constitution. I mean, would it be feasible to have legislation dealing explicitly with that? Or would the differences, the different procedures and the different responsibilities of the various government departments make that a theoretical exercise not worth doing? Would it have to be, would legislation have to be specific to particular departments?
Just a clarification, maybe from Steve. Referring to Doctors for Life case, quite clearly in terms of public participation, Judge Nova and others, they express themselves quite clearly. But you know, trying to follow you with regard to the Communal Land Act bill, is it? And the victory of the Mkhuze people, and then the subsequent scrambling. My view would be, with the Doctors for Life decision, the right of the community cannot be taken away in the light of that constitutional decision. So even if then the subsequent scrambling that says the minister only can do what's name, it cannot be. It cannot. I mean, virtually, I don't know whether I'm misunderstanding in trying to align those two cases, the Doctors for Life and what has happened in the communal land situation. In other words, the attempt to take away the community's rights is not possible. Am I wrong?
Just on sections 28, 29 and 30 dealing with the NCOP, it presents a very rosy, favourable picture of what either is happening or could happen. I'm not quite sure what it is. Because it says it's the area of the province has the greatest impact in the realm of concurrence and shared realm, the greatest opportunity to influence law and socio-economic transformation. Each of the amendments of each province must be considered. It's significant for the first time national legislation is being debated in the provinces and giving the public opportunity to impact on national and provincial politics. Is it being debated in the provinces? I get a different impression that a mandate of sorts comes and filters back, but that there are six permanent representatives of each of the provinces, and they all sit in their own party caucuses at national level, and there tends to be a decision taken on national policies in Parliament. I'm not saying there's no mandate given, but have you checked? Is this being debated in the provinces? And have there been amendments moved from each of the provinces and considered by Parliament? I'm not aware of it.
The brochure mentions of 15 standard articles that the people think that while many people are already on holiday, Parliament is busy crafting the public participation model that will be finalized in the new year. In response to the topic for license proposed. So that is as much news as we have on the issue of a new model. That may or may not be reflected in joint rules of Parliament. Because it's so different in different legislation. The best practice model for public participation in our constitution is the way it was written, with participation both generally and then in technical committees. And some technical committees were very effective what Section 76 offers does not happen in practice. But Section 76 does offer participation, theoretically, statutorily, the opportunity to debate national legislation in province and also in province. In practice, it does not appear to happen. You were asked a general question about the effectiveness of public participation. It does not. It is uneven. On the second of November, the Portfolio Committee of Environmental Affairs and Tourism at Yeri, there were 72 submissions made. 10 participants at that hearing, two of which supported the vote. The balance did not support the vote. Busa, Unity of South Africa, and the Chamber of Mines supported the vote and also mentioned that they participated with the department in writing the vote. The objections were, the balance, the 70 other parties objected to the vote. And there is no explanation for them afterwards why there were no changes made.
Sometimes there's no equality in measures about one section should be amended and one section should be parliamentary authority, and then says what it says and the executive engage with civil society or stakeholders will be the executive commission before they come to Parliament. And later on, and rather than the citizens sort out these different conflicting pieces of information, they should be dealt with elsewhere. So this is where the Department of Justice is responsible, that is very uneven with regards to whether they consult with stakeholders prior to the information coming to the authorities. There was a concern about it because it means that hearing that to be adjourned for a consultation process that is necessary. And also, there was a concern about the information. Parliament, of course, is never there to agree to the process of the executive and the civil society. Parliament says there are differences of view on policy issues. And the civil society is stakeholders. Parliament is held to actually able to resolve that situation.
I agree with that. But the one that's impacted off his life is the department is attacking the constitutional court in such a legal. If he has to be correct, it will be involved.
On Bill 10 and Bill 36 that are still remains incompatible. Both appear in today's order paper, and it's in public call for joint hearing and sitting, or rather a joint sitting of the two parliamentary committees to resolve it. But in the meantime, the public has been left in the dark, and the Parliament has got to resolve the executive coming up and the approaches to environmental review.